today two texts which are in implicit but not explicit dialogue with one another, grappling with related and overlapping but not identical issues. Butler speaks of precarity and precariousness and the link between those two. Nixon speaks about slow violence and what he calls disposable casualties. Butler's organizing metaphor is visual. She gives us the idea of framing and the frame. She refers to Volpe's means work of art essay. But Nixon wants to challenge the privileging of the visual. He's committed to stories and to writing, to narrative, or more accurately, I suppose, we should say counter-narrative. So we have the emphasis on framing in Butler and on narrative or re-narrative in Nixon. Both theorists approach politics and the crisis of contemporary life through a strongly marked ethical sensibility. They're interested in justice, in equality, in what Butler calls radical democracy. It's interesting that the weight of Butler's critique falls on the state. She speaks specifically of state violence, while the weight of Nixon's critique falls on capitalism in its current, that is to say, deregulated or neoliberal or globalized avatar or form. Left politics, as Butler puts it, and both theorists write from the progressive side of the political agenda. So here is Butler speaking about the need to focus and expand the political critique of state violence. So specifically speaking about the violence of the state. Those are those forms of legalized violence by which populations are differentially deprived of the basic resources needed to minimize precariousness. And she emphasizes this in the contemporary context of what she calls crumbling welfare states. Situations in which people are becoming more and more precarious, on one hand, through structural unemployment, through casualization, through etc. Also is the time at which a very specific form of state violence is being imposed on people, not necessarily the same people, but that's her context. Precarity, she says, cuts across identity categories as well as multicultural maps. She's very particular here to argue that what's needed is are new kinds of coalitions which are not the same as the sort of multiculturalist or identitarian programs. The idea of single issue politics or identity politics of any kind for Butler is situated in the past in some ways, but also she suggests that it's actually politically inadequate as a form of organizing. I think that's an interesting line for her to take up in this book, partly because she is associated with identity politics, rightly or wrongly, on the basis of much of her previous work. Nixon, his focus is slightly different. Here he is speaking about the structural violence embodied by a neoliberal order of austerity measures, structural adjustment, rampant deregulation, corporate mega mergers, and a widening gulf between rich and poor. And he argues that that is a form of covert violence in its own right. That's the basis of his argument. So as I say, with Butler, she focuses very much on state violence. Nixon focuses in general here on capitalism, although of course there are some issues about Nixon's focus on capitalism, which other critics responding to Nixon have argued that although he speaks about the widening gulf between rich and poor, he tends to speak about climate change or about ecological disaster as something which affects us all, rather than in fact as something which affects us very differentially. And we'll look at that in the next couple of weeks. How exactly should we be describing climate change or the Anthropocene or whatever it is that we speak of here? Some of the differences in register and orientation between the two writers can be attributed, I think, to their different disciplinary formations. Butler was trained as a philosopher. Her first book was on the French reception of Hegel, sort of late 80s. Although she now teaches in the unusually named Department of Rhetoric and Comparative Literature at Berkeley. She's been enormously influential as a feminist theorist. I'm sure that you've read her work in other fields, with her work on gender, sex, and sexuality. But she's also very active as a political philosopher more generally. Nixon was trained in literary studies as a post-colonialist. But it's his work in environmental concerns or in social movements, particularly as those pertain to the Global South, that's brought him his biggest audience. And he now teaches at Princeton, where he's professor in humanities and the environment, based in the English department and also co in the English department and the Princeton Environmental Institute. In her opening comments, Butler says that she's seeking to draw attention to the epistemological problem, let's say related concerning knowledge, raised by the issue of framing. The frames through which we apprehend or indeed fail to apprehend the lives of others as lost or injured, losable or injurable, are politically saturated, she says. They're themselves operations of power. On the other hand, the problem is ontological, since the question at issue is what is a life? And she goes into both of those hands, if you like, the one concerning knowledge, the other concerning being in some way. And very obviously her emphasis here on the fact that if you focus on the frame, on the way in which discourses or concepts are framed, then automatically you're talking not just about knowledge in the abstract, but about the ability to have your understanding prevail. It isn't just a question of saying, oh, let's try a different frame, because you can try out different frames, but which frames stick? Which frames are the ones that become the basis for social thinking more widely? Which frames become the basis for policy and for political action? And if we think about the ways in which these frames occur, I mean, Butler takes up the question of the abortion rights movement. So the sense in which you have, on the one hand, a woman's right to choose, and you hear the framing there in terms of the ability to choose, to exercise your own judgment, the idea of self-determination, all of those kinds of things. Also, of course, in the very idea of choice, perhaps unfortunately, a kind of a certain gesturing towards consumerism, etc. I mean, that's one of the liabilities of that. On the other hand, of course, the anti-abortion movement speaks of the right to life. These are frames. These are ways of actually conceptualizing what's at issue here. And there is a political dispute between those two. Between those two positions. It isn't just a question of how you understand abortion rights, for instance, or abortion itself. It's a question of how the entire discourse, the entire debate is positioned, which is why Butler is insisting on power all the way down here for her. She's saying that And what's at issue here isn't just content. In other words, what is abortion or what isn't, when does life begin, as though those would make those points. I mean, if we think about the general sanction against murder, for instance, and think of the problem posed by war in these things. Isn't war understood as murder? But of course, war is understood as as in some sense just or sanctioned murder. So the way in which these things are framed becomes crucial. So it isn't just about content, or about context even, as conventionally understood, in other words, of specifying where one is speaking from, or what one's ideological assumptions are, or what one's situation is, where, to whom one speaks, to what ends, etc. It's clear that for Butler, as well as for Nixon, words and vocabularies and lexicons matter. I mean, there's the often cited observation, for instance, about Margaret Thatcher, that she changed the substance of common sense. If we think about this, how did she do this in some way? In one way, was it by using a different vocabulary, a different language, premised on different sorts of assumptions, which seem to sink deeply in. So that for us today, 30, 40 years afterwards, it's very hard to think otherwise. In some ways, the way in which we thought in 1975 has been obliterated and replaced by another way of thinking. And the whole question is how one can... So in other words, there's another frame that's at issue here. How does one get beyond that frame? And this is very much what Judith Butler is concerned with. You probably know Bertolt Brecht's great poem, "The Worker Reads History." I thought I'd just play you a reading of this poem, and you'll see that what Brecht is doing here is to try and construct another frame for the understanding of history. I mean, he's thinking of the way in which history is taught as this kind of procession of great men, for instance, Alexander the Great, Frederick II, Henry VIII, etc. And Brecht constantly is saying, were they the only actors at this time? What about those people who built the Great Wall of China, for instance?
Who built the seven gates of Thebes? In the books you'll find the names of kings. Did kings hand up the blocks of stone? And Babylon, so many times destroyed, who rebuilt it? In which of Lima's houses, that glittering city of gold, did the builders live? In the evening, when the Chinese wall was finished, where did the masons go? Imperial Rome, with all its arcs of triumph, who erected them? Over who did the Caesars triumph? Byzantium lives in song, with all their homes, palaces, and even in legendary Atlantis, the night the seas rushed in, the drowning still bellowed for their slaves. Young Alexander conquered India, on his own. Caesar beat the Gauls. Did he not even have a cook with him? Philip of Spain wept when the Armada was sunk. Was he the only one to weep? Frederick the Great won the 7 Years' War. Who else won it? Every page a victory. Who cooked the victory feast? Every 10 years, a great man. Who paid the bill? So much history, so many questions.
So what's at issue here is framing. It's not difficult to understand. I think what is difficult in Butler is the particular way in which she approaches this question through a deconstructive logic, where she wants to argue. One would imagine that if the question were of framing, what you would suggest is another frame, a different frame. Here in the Brecht. A frame which is conscious of popular involvement. For instance, I'm thinking of the of Raymond Williams's great essay on culture is ordinary, where you can hear already he's arguing for a different frame in the very title, where he's saying that when he encounters as a working class boy coming from Pandy on the Welsh borders, comes to Cambridge and is confronted by these buildings, which are celebrated as the, in a sense, the buildings of the aristocracy. And Williams is particularly interested in saying, no, they aren't. They're a national inheritance, a national heritage. They ought to be something that registers Britishness rather than the significance of the elite. English culture, he says, is not elite culture, or in a different context, it's not bourgeois culture. It's to be understood as a national inheritance. He's changing the frame. So he's coming up with a different frame. But Butler's approach to this is through a certain kind of logic, which I would say the deconstruction involves, rather than the substitution of another frame, it involves a jamming of the machinery of representation. So Butler is very concerned. The most difficult parts, I suppose, of her analysis are where she suggests, in some senses, if you ask the question of who is doing the framing, or of the framer framed, as she put it, turning the gaze on the framer, what happens is that the framing itself begins to break open, to explode under the weight of its own contradictions. That framing itself becomes crucial. So she says that she approaches this through a distinction between recognizing and apprehending. Recognition is the stronger term, and she says that it's been derived from Hegelian texts. We've spoken of the idea of intersubjectivity in some ways. That if you recognize rights in some senses, you're recognizing that the subject who has those rights is a full subject. And she's talking about something quite different. Apprehension, she says, can imply marking, registering, acknowledging without full cognition. It's a form of knowing, it's bound up with sensing and perceiving, but in ways that are not always, or they're not yet, she says, conceptual forms of knowledge. Think of how, when we were discussing reification, for instance, we suggested that reification was a kind of forgetting. And what was forgotten often were the invisible traces of labor in the product. So the labor is, you know, when we go to Starbucks and we buy our coffee, and we are dimly aware, that's what I take apprehending to be, dimly aware of the fact that there in the shadows to be is an entire regime of production in some way. But we don't take it in fully. We don't recognize, is the word that Butler would use here. This is an apprehension, not a recognition. And in fact, apprehension, because it's only apprehended, it can often be forgotten again, or taken as of little regard. Nixon draws this point out more clearly, as we'll say later. She says that the frame permits, even requires, this breaking out. Is that what I've... Oh, no, sorry, that's not where we are yet. So that's where she's speaking here. Once she's established this point about recognition and apprehension, she suggests that we have to understand that what's involved is not simply including more people under the old schema of representation. I think implicitly we can understand the challenge here as a critique of the Habermasian paradigm in some way. She says that the problem isn't how to include more people within existing norms. Habermas argued that in the bourgeois public sphere was always implicitly open to all. The critique is that, of course, it's open to all under the existing rules. But what if the existing rules themselves are discriminatory? What if, for instance, our idea, we say, oh, human rights. What if human rights, if the way in which we conceptualize human rights is Eurocentric, is bourgeois specific? How do we blast open the idea of what human rights are so that they can be reformulated? And this is what Dr. Eichink is suggesting here. What new norms are possible? What new definitions? What new frames, even? And how are they to be wrought? What might be done to produce a more egalitarian set of conditions for recognizability? The idea is that recognizability is, in some sense, where we want to go. What you want to do is to recognize the other's full existence as yourself in a different circumstance. So that sense of the other, if we can understand ourselves as other, that we would want that movement from self and other not to involve a loss of subjectivity, a loss of opportunity, a loss of agency. One wants to say something about ourselves and others, but the others would be understood as having claims, rights, sensibilities similar to our own. So when one says something like Syrian refugees, for instance, one doesn't want a loss of recognition to enter into that thing. Does Syrian refugees mean something less? Does it involve a sense of which we are not accountable? It's this that Butler is attacking. What might be done to shift the very terms of recognizability in order to produce more radically democratic results? And I think her idea of radical democracy here is obviously not nation-specific. It's not nation-based. It might work through nations, but it isn't something, it's global. This is it's a global conception. Her epistemology, her ontology, and her politics are global, not national. she suggests that when we think of the frame in these terms, when we ask these kinds of questions, the frame begins to, almost like it's to dissolve or to break up. It becomes less obvious. It gets challenged and its authority is disrupted. But I'm very struck by her questions here. The frame permits or even requires this breaking up. She gives us an example of the Guantanamo prisoners kneeling, the public outrage that ensued. What happens at such moments, she asks? Are they merely transient moments, or are they, in fact, occasions when the frame as a forcible and plausible con is exposed? I mean, she's playing on the idea of frame. You frame somebody, but resulting in a critical and exuberant release from the force of illegitimate authority. Those questions, I think, are tremendously interesting questions, but they're also very Butlerian, I would say, which is to say, she seems to assume that the answer is the latter, resulting in a critical and exuberant release from the force of illegitimate authority. She seems to assume that the jamming, the mechanism aspect of framing the framer will produce these liberatory, emancipatory conclusions. And the very fact that time has passed since she wrote those words, I think gives those questions a horrible tendency to return to her and to ask her what has happened actually? Were they merely transient moments? And if they were merely transient, that sense of outrage, how could people be treated this way? If in fact nothing changed and we went on, and we then forgot again. Recognition slid back into apprehension. Does this reflect on Butler's theory in some way? Do you need to do something more than jamming the machinery? Butler says that, of course, coming up with other frames or other narratives is also a good thing. But my sense is she doesn't spend enough time exactly focusing on those. Perhaps she assumes that other activists are already doing all that work. She wants to focus more on this frame of framing aspect. But I think there are some weaknesses in the theory here. When the book first came out, I was quite struck by those questions. When I read them this weekend, just thinking, I thought, wow, a lot of time has gone by, and maybe the answer to those questions is that actually are they just transient moments? They didn't result in anything different. And is that the fault of ourselves as we fail to push through things? Or is it, in some senses, is her thinking about this too voluntaristic? It's an open question. She says the production of new frames is clearly important, but we would miss a critical dimension if we restricted ourselves to this view. What happens when a frame breaks within itself, and so on, so that it's taken for granted reality is called into question? This is the sense in which Lukács and Marx already came up with this idea that when they confound common sense and when they say, look, let's unpack the riddle of the commodity, what Marx emphasizes in doing that is that this insight changes nothing in some ways. In fact, Marx insists, on the contrary, that seeing the world upside down is how the world is. That in some ways, what does it take to change the world? You might say that knowing or that understanding the question of framing is a crucial part of that action, but it's not sufficient for them. My suggestion is that Butler is too quick here in saying it's clearly important, but I'm not going to say anything more about that. It's too swift. So we have when she says something exceeds the frame that troubles our sense of reality, and so on. I think it's too, in a sense, it's almost too easy. Let me point to one other aspect that I find problematic in Butler, and this is the willed emphasis on the body or on bodiliness. Now, one understands what she's doing here. She's attempting to criticize the abstract or the idealist, liberal, and individualist notion which spoke of the person or the human. Whenever I read her, I find myself struck by the fact that she uses the body where I would use the human or the person. Bodies come into being. Well, they do, but it's not only bodies, is it, that come into being. The body is exposed to socially and politically articulated forces. She's drawing on Foucault, very obviously, there. And the body is exposed, but it's not only the body, is it? It's ourselves are exposed, and more than just bodies. So what is more than just bodies, but less than or different from persons, if we understand persons as being liberal persons or individuals in some way? Butler holds on to the idea of bodies always, but the very fact that it reads strangely, I think, indicates that some other kind of, some notion of subjectivity is waiting to be born here. None of the existing theories of subjectivity seem quite to satisfy her, because they maybe they're too denying of bodiliness, of embodiment, of corporeality, of the material aspect of the body. But surely one needs both. These are necessary features. This idea they're subjected to incursions, to illnesses that jeopardize the possibility of persisting at all. They cannot be thought without their finitude, etc. So she is talking about materiality, but that idea of features that pertain to the phenomenological structure of bodily life. The moment you're speaking about the phenomenological structure, you're speaking about intentions and consciousness as well, which exceeds bodiliness. To live is always to live a life that's at risk from the outset. It's not bodies who live. It's ourselves who live. I mean, we are embodied, if you understand the point that I'm making. But just to focus on this aspect for one second, because it seems to be slightly problematical in her analysis. Let me go on. I realised when I was making up the lecture that, of course, as always, you think I can put these two theorists together, and never works because you need like an hour and a half on each. But think about precariousness and precarity as she theorizes this. She seems to suggest that thinking about the first, this peculiar sense in which we have to take ethical responsibility, accountability for all, That is, in a sense, where we might start our politics, as a kind of a universal politics of accountability. This automatically brings precarity into the frame, and the moment you think about precariousness, precarity becomes a scandal, an outrage. There should be no precarity. Precariousness is a given, because we are always subject to sudden sudden illness, if you like, the sudden sort of eclipse of life. A tsunami could happen, an avalanche. We could be run over. Precariousness, we are mortal. That makes us precarious. But precarity is a different conception. And she is suggesting that if we think precariousness globally and universally, then precarity is what we cannot, we ought not to abide, in a sense. So I'm suggesting that if reification is forgetting, what is apprehension for these two theorists? With Butler positions apprehension, it's not quite recognition, it's just this dim awareness of something. Nixon has a slightly different take on this. How do we bring home threats that take time to wreak their havoc, he says. Apprehension is a critical word here, a crossover term that draws together the domains of perception, emotion, and action. And just as Butler had done with the frame, so with apprehension, Nixon thinks etymologically about the word itself. To apprehend something is to see it, but to apprehend something is also to arrest something, to stop something. And so apprehension is both a kind of perceptual schema. You apprehend it dimly in the background, but if you think about apprehension, it's also where, in some sense, that dim kind of consciousness stops. You can bring things to a halt at those moments. To engage slow violence is to confront layered predicaments of apprehension. To apprehend often imperceptible threats requires rendering them apprehensible to the senses, and so on. What, in the fullest sense of the phrase, is the place of seeing in the world we now inhabit? Here he's moving towards this idea of challenging the privilege of the visible. Because what Nixon wants to do, obviously, is to challenge this. Once we think of the visible, we're also thinking of the sensation. 9/11 becomes the paradigmatic moment there. Those towers collapsing in the now, an event. The very fact we speak of 9/11, it's a day, it's a moment, it's an hour, as it were, as distinct from the long-term, long-drawn-out, the long dying, as he calls it, of climate change or Anthropocene violence. Here's Benjamin Kunkel's definition, just discussion of various definitions of Anthropocene. And I think there are real questions for us of how we understand. If we accept the premise of the Anthropocene, when do we see it as beginning? What exactly is involved in it? And we see a variety of others: 1800, August the 6th, 1945, which is the moment of the atomic bomb, etc. The idea of the Anthropocene, says Kunkel, is to say human beings now largely determine the makeup of the biosphere, as well as the chemistry of the atmosphere and oceans. And this episode of the species dominion will one day be as legible in the fossil record, asteroid impacts or proliferation of new life forms. So the sense of the Anthropocene as a change in geological time is what's being emphasized. And to draw this out in some ways, I mean, this is obviously this is a heat sensing map around the coast of Australia, focusing mostly on the Great Barrier Reef, which, as you know, is being bleached catastrophically. Have you visited? Has anyone been to the Has anyone been? Well, of course, you were there last year, weren't you? Well, if you haven't, you need to go quickly, is the point, because literally it won't be there. But, I mean, the entire stretches of the reef are now white, bleach white. The coral has died and may and probably never will recur. Here's 2016-2017 maps, and what I'm saying, most severe bleaching, mostly in the north, up north of Cairns. This is an extraordinary length of coral, which is dying. 26% dead, 67% dead in the one place. These extraordinary effects being measured here. Nixon focuses on the idea of disposable casualties in some way. These are the words of Nixon talking about the bombing of Cambodia in the late 60s, early 70s. You have to remember that Cambodia was not at war with the United States. Cambodia was on the border, and it was because it was on the border of Vietnam, the Americans decided to bomb it back to the Stone Age, as the expression goes, in order to make it unusable by the Viet Cong as a conduit, that they could not use the area at all. The entire operation was kept secret from the American public, and in fact from Congress itself, until 1973. So during the time I think more bombs were dropped on Cambodia, which was not at war with the United States, in that period than had been dropped by both sides combined in the entirety of the Second World War. Extraordinary violence. Over 14 months, more than the total drop by the Allies, in World War II, hidden from the American public. So what we're talking about here is this is not slow violence in the first instance, because people die. But Nixon makes the point that when one attempts to take the casualties of the war effort, of what was involved, that when we say something like in the 14 years of the American involvement, 1.5 million people, it's a devastating figure. But it barely begins to touch the surface of the long-term violence done. People whose lives are made, whose lives in Butler's terms are rendered not livable by this event. Now, what enables these events to happen is, as Butler keeps pointing out, the differential allocation of precariousness. You say that these people do not, they are not recognized as ourselves, so therefore they are bombable in some ways. And one gets these kinds of arguments about the conditions for a just war. As though these things could be, I mean, these of course are very old, going back thousands of years where the justifications for war have taken place. But what Nixon is suggesting is that whenever you're in the province of just war arguments, slow violence is taking place. That is a form of covert violence, he suggests. This scene, which I'm sure you remember from Alan Kurdi, dead on a beach in Turkey, which prompted again action. I mean, it's another one of those events that the framer was seen to burst broken open. The frame broke with this, when this picture was published. But what has changed, as it were? You've probably been reading just this week of Sajid Javid's, or since the beginning of the year, 289 refugees attempted to come to Britain illegally on boats, and he declared a state of a sort of a national emergency. He deployed the Navy if you think of what's involved here in terms of the framing, are they refugees? Are they migrants? Legal migrants? Illegal migrants? Etc. In the background, we have this question of both slow violence and what is a grievable life. What's not asked is what would cause people to take to the seas so dangerously. What Javed keeps saying is that, oh, you know, we want to stop illegal migration at source. In some ways, we want to prevent the criminalization of this, the fact that there are gangs exploiting people. Yes, there are gangs exploiting people, but this is a grievable life. And what Butler is suggesting in some ways is that there has to be a different conception. Again, just another image. I keep thinking when you look at these images of we can contemplate pictures like this. I mean, it's hard to contemplate this picture or the Kurdi thing with equanimity, I would say. I mean, it's profoundly disturbing. But we then, we're sort of disturbed and then we go on, as it were. In half an hour we'll go and have our tea or our coffee, as it were. So that peculiar sense in which if the frame is broken, it isn't broken for long enough. We ought to be permanently destabilized, presumably, by images like this. We ought to be able to put ourselves in the position where we can ask the question of, what is a grievable life? In what ways can we not see that the lives that these people were leading was unlivable, which is what makes them moved, do desperate things? How is this not part of what we understand routinely? Here from Carson's The Silent Spring, something about the long-term effects of slow violence, and this is from Naomi Klein, who writes this excellent book called This Changes Everything. Where she speaks of the sense that it was a logic, the control of nature is what's at issue. That particular way in which that it's a particular way of thinking about objectivity, about the world that seems to be at issue. Couple of images from Mumbai. I went to visit a friend who lives on the sort of Great Crescent of Mumbai. And he lives in a high rise, maybe it's 15 stories up. And I'd never been to Mumbai before, went up and I looked out at the sea and it looked pretty, which was the hideous thing about it. There were these beautiful kind of colours sparkling in the ocean. And I asked him, what those were, as it were. And he says, oh, because it went out. I don't know, it was all over the beach, but like 500 meters out to sea. And he said, oh, it's congealed plastics and refuse. But from up where I was, quite a way, once you've got the binoculars, you could see, and it's quite hideous. People are living there. So the question is this a life being lived? People are walking, but we know immediately the devastating effects, the kind of illnesses, the infectious diseases that are occurring. But as far out as you could see also were the plastics, and then beyond the plastics were sort of the dark brown effluent, as it were. And then, sort of further, with distance, you could see the sea gradually resuming a kind of a blue colour. But an extraordinary long way. I've never seen anything like it. So it was the kind of just the clutter, the waste, the refuse, and then the brown, and then in the far distance, the ocean. But that sense of both, you can see both Butler and Nixon's inquiries coming together in scenes like that. Here from contemporary Syria, and these are the sorts of images that always make me think of that question of how would one live? let's say that one weren't murdered by the bombs falling on one. Although, of course, it would be, if you were there, you couldn't have survived, could you? But you have survived somehow. You're in the next street over. This is your neighborhood. We're not talking about existential life, as Butler calls it. In other words, we're not talking about the life of bodies, of being alive. We're talking about life as a social practice, forms of sociality, language, discourse, people meeting, talking to one another. The question is that you could have the arguments for just war or not just war. You know, Assad is a murderous dictator, etc., etc. ISIS is a murderous cabal, and so on and so forth. But beyond or somewhere not related to those discussions are those sorts of scenes. It occurs to me that where life is just is unimaginable in those circumstances. I mean, you can't speak about life. What is a grievable life? That question is already lost when you come up with an image like that. You all know Joni. Do you know Joni Mitchell's? So I won't even bother to play it then. But that sense of, you know, the question of DDT in the song, and the idea of the commodity styling of fruit and vegetables, for instance, on the one hand, which makes them look good in Sainsbury's, as against the longer term effects of DDT or Agent Orange or whatever it could be. This is also another track. One could go interestingly into the discussion of how environmental despoilation is covered in popular culture. Here from Traffic in, I think, the early 70s, this desire often to personify nature here through an eagle, and the sense in which always that nature is going to strike back is such an important part of the kind of political imagination. Of course, it's not true. What one finds is that nature is annihilated, like everything else, but that in a microflash you're going to feel the lash of Big Eagle's wing across your back. You could see this as a kind of a political wish fulfillment in some ways, but it doesn't work that way. Nixon talks about the Marshall Islands. I don't know if any of you looked up the Marshall Islands, but so here we are. Basically, it's up there, the Tabarak, Nauru as well. So we're talking Australia here, then past Indonesia, Papua New Guinea, past the Solomon Islands, and the Bikini Atoll is up there as well. This is the area in which one of the islands still belongs to the United States, and you need a special diplomatic passport to go to it. But as Nixon points out, the island public was in part governed by irradiated past well into the 1980s, as he says, its history of nuclear colonialism, long forgotten by the colonizers, was still delivering into the world jellyfish babies, headless, eyeless, limbless human infants who would live for just a few hours. Disposable casualties is Nixon's term for this, but we're talking about the geopolitics of apprehension, or the geopolitics of forgetting. It's very easy if you focus just on the United States or just on ourselves as Brits. In some ways. If we can forget all that out there, Nixon gives us both the spectre of environmental damage, but also of labor exploitation. If our computers are put together under horrible circumstances somewhere over there in China, you can see why it's in the interests of the manufacturers to make us forget that fact. We want our computers not to have those marks on them. We don't want to be made aware of what's happening in Nauru or elsewhere. I was struck by this image. I know, of course, that Princess Diana had a strong interest in landmines. This is from Angola, where, again, and you could say a theatre of the Cold War. So between the old Soviet Union and the United States in the 1960s and 70s, the pretext, if that's the right word, being the liberation of Angola from Portuguese colonialism. One understands there the disposal. Notice also, though, there's something to be said. I mean, this is what gets called poverty porn, isn't it? There's something to be said about the visualization. Why does it take Princess Diana to do that? She's drawing attention. She is, in fact, trying to construct a different sort of narrative. But I'm also intrigued by what was going on. What is Naomi Watts thinking, as it were? How is she understanding her own move? I mean, she's so obviously styled herself on Princess Diana here. How do we understand her visit to the same camps years later? And why are these images so photogenic? Why is that necessary? Where Nixon talks about the construction of different kinds of narratives, you can see perhaps why he's opposed to the visual. I would say that the idea, even though these are progressive liberal images, don't they themselves do a kind of damage? I mean, these are open questions because you could argue that they also do a kind of good. But I think those sorts of issues are being played out in that debate. I mean, I'm very interested in the fact that Nixon, of course, is a writer. He's a creative writer also, where Butler isn't. But Butler seems to have more interest in the idea of the visual image, the idea of paintings, of frames, therefore of photos also. So that gives us something to talk about, hopefully tomorrow. I'm happy to have any kinds of questions asked about either of the texts. So just come with your own issues. See you tomorrow.